Call this meeting the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 5:38 p.m. It is Thursday, April 13, 2017. Before we begin, I want to thank Christie Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Kelsey Goodell from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and everyone in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Kopp, Representative Reinbold, Representative Christ Tompkins, my vice chair, Representative Fansler, and myself, Representative Clayman. And we do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 204, Overtaking Passing DOT Vehicles, sponsored by Representative Kawasaki. This is the first hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee, and here to introduce the bill is Representative Kawasaki. Would the bill sponsor and his staff please identify themselves for the record, and then you may begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, Representative Scott Kawasaki, House District 1.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, Mercedes Colbert, staff to Representative Kawasaki.
I'd like to thank members for hearing this bill just 1 week after National Work Zone Awareness Week. As the skies get brighter and the sunshine is shining outside, road construction season approaches. I wanted to first say thank you to Mr. Dan Carson. Dan Carson is an equipment operator in Fairbanks who brought this to our attention in the first place. My staff, William Jod Wallace, has been working on this piece of legislation, and I'd like to thank everybody here who's helped strengthen the bill.
And just to interrupt for just a moment, I want to recognize that Representative Ledoux has joined us. Thank you, and please continue.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Currently under state law 2835-185, drivers are required to vacate the nearest lane and slow down when approaching certain emergency vehicles, service vehicles that include fire, law enforcement, animal control vehicles, and tow trucks that are in the act of picking up a vehicle. It's also commonly known as the move-over law. In its current form, as introduced, the House Transportation Committee bill would add DOT vehicles with flashing lights that are performing road maintenance or road work as well. If a driver approaches one of these vehicles with flashing lights on the highway with two or more lanes traveling in the same direction, that driver would vacate that lane and go to the closest lane safely. On a road with fewer than two lanes traveling the same direction, the driver would just generally slow down to a reasonable speed. I know that there's a committee CS that will probably be introduced.
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
So, it's
coming up shortly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was discussion in the previous House Transportation Committee, appreciative of that. Some of the discussion surrounded whether it's just Department of Transportation vehicles or should it be maybe some other vehicles, and I know the chairs worked on that language along with other members of this committee when that comes up. Also wanted to thank Representative Kopp from the previous committee. I don't know if you saw the new sponsor substitute, but we made sure that Representative Kopp did remind us that Mr. Robert Hamill passed away at mile 88. He was a DOT worker of the Seward Highway. He was a DOT worker who was tragically struck and killed while laying down traffic cones while a vehicle was going to be there while a vehicle was stranded on the side of the roadway in 2012. And so we've incorporated his name into the sponsor statement that currently is before you. And I appreciate Representative Kopp in that. The penalty under the statute would be considered a failure to move over as a Class A misdemeanor if personal injury results in the person's failure to vacate the lane or slow down. Failure to move over does not result in personal injury. It's still punishable by a $150 traffic infraction and 2 points assessed against the driver's license. This statute has been in effect since September 2005. So far, the Department of Public Safety, under this statute, there were 23 violations in 2016, 14 in 2015, and 53 in 2014. Members should have this information in their packet as well. There are many laws in other states. In fact, there was a death just recently in South Carolina of two Department of Transportation safety workers who were killed recently while they were working in March. And so there's legislation all across the country dealing specifically with this issue. Let's see. I guess that is it, unless there are questions of the committee.
Any questions from the committee members of Representative Kawasaki? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair. Now, when I think of DOT vehicles, I often think of vehicles that might be moving, but it looks like the language here just deals with a stationary vehicle, and I'm wondering what's the discussion, was there discussion on vehicles moving at a slow speed doing some type of road work?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, that doesn't specifically, it's not specifically addressed in this piece of legislation, but there are slow-moving vehicles denoted with a slow-moving vehicle sign. I don't even know if it's in this statute to be addressed, though.
And actually, before we take more questions, what I'd like to do is actually move the committee substitute, so we're talking about the committee substitute, which is the bill we're really talking about, rather than the original bill. Representative Fansler, could I have a motion?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Klayman. I move that House Judiciary Committee adopt the committee substitute to House Bill 204, that's version 30-LS0685-D, as our working document.
Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, then we have adopted the CS as our committee, as our working document. Okay.
And, Mr. Chairman, we have somebody to address the rest of the question for Representative Eastman.
All right.
Hi, through the chair, Representative Eastman, this is Mercedes Colbert. That has come in discussions mostly with other contractors and other DOT representatives, and we essentially found that there isn't actually a statute already in place for slow-moving vehicles, but I believe that we do have someone here from the Department of Law that can speak to that, too, and the state troopers online, I think, as well, that may be able to tell you more about the enforcement aspects of it, but that was something that came in discussion, and we felt that it could be under discussion. You know, it's just not something that's actually under statute at the time. Yes, does that answer your question?
Yes, I would be curious what the, you know, apparently there is no penalty currently if it's not in statute. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman. So our bill only addressed stationary vehicles, and so the format of the bill is very simple. We didn't at all talk about the slow-moving vehicle aspect within the context of this bill. But, again, there is somebody from the Department of Law and the Alaska State Troopers present that can answer that question.
And Representative Eastman, what we'll do is people that are available, we'll bring them up later. And if you remind me, we can certainly ask them that question. Any other questions about the bill to the bill sponsor? Representative Kopp.
Chairman, so I really appreciate the bill sponsor bringing this forward. We heard it in transportation. It's a bill I strongly support. And, Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that, this section of Title 28 just deals with stationary emergency vehicles, so it would be a more extensive rewrite if we got into slow-moving emergency vehicles. And one reason why we don't is because if an emergency vehicle that we are coming upon is slow-moving, we don't know which way it's going to go, and the law shouldn't direct you to try to go around it. In other words, it may be more appropriate to move over and stop, which is what we do to oncoming emergency vehicles now. So there's probably a good reason why that's not addressed as far as going around. It is a different situation and should be addressed separately in the law.
Okay. I don't see any other questions or comments. So this
another question.
You can open the public hearing. Go ahead, Representative Eastman. We're not moving the bill yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious if you have a situation where a DOT vehicle ever stops to render aid to an emergency situation. Do you have those kinds of situations come up, or has that just never happened? Because it wouldn't seem to me that would be categorized.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the the Mr. Hamill, who I brought up earlier, was in that particular case. There was a state trooper. The state trooper rendered aid to a vehicle that was stopped on the side of the road. That trooper ended up, with his flashing lights, ended up going to a case that was 10 miles away on the Seward Highway. Then he got a call saying that there was an injury at the original place, and that was where Mr. Hamill was actually rendering aid to a vehicle that was in on the side of the road. And in that case, that person, Mr. Hamill, died as a result of those injuries. And so that's exactly the sort of case in which a DOT person is placing cones, working alongside law enforcement to ensure that if there's a vehicle that's stranded on the road, it doesn't become a further hazard for other drivers.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Just looking at the language here, it wouldn't seem to me immediately apparent that someone who was not doing service on the road or performing maintenance on the road would be covered. But you think that would be covered?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I mean, the committee can consider it, but the language seems pretty accurate that if the vehicle is in the act of performing maintenance or road service work, that person would, in fact, be covered.
All right, we can come back to that. Thank you.
All right, if there are no other questions, I'm going to go ahead and open the public hearing on this bill. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on this bill? I don't see anyone online. I have Mike Coffey from the Department of Transportation who wanted to testify. Mr. Coffey, can you hear us?
Yes, can you hear me?
We can. If you want to go ahead with your testimony, we ask testimony to be limited to 3 minutes, so go ahead and be sure to state your name, any affiliation in terms of who you're testifying on behalf of, and go forth.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Coffey. I wear two hats for the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I'm the director of the South Coast Region, and I'm also the head of statewide maintenance and operations. Just a real quick background on myself so that you know where I'm speaking from. I'm almost a 35-year employee with the Department of Transportation. About 20 years of my time with DOT has been in maintenance and operations. I've had the good fortune to serve in all three regions across the state in different elements of maintenance and operations, and I actually have been the head of statewide maintenance operations for the last 8 to 9 years. The reason I bring this up is to basically highlight my knowledge of the safety challenges that our maintenance crews face across the entire state. Every day in the state of Alaska, we have DOT maintenance and operations personnel serving in harm's way while working on and adjacent to the state's highways. For years, I have personally witnessed and heard of stories of injuries and near misses from our maintenance professionals. I myself have almost been hit while working on the road in previous positions. Across the state, we have moving vehicles, snowplows, graders that are being run into. More specifically, on stationary vehicles, we have people ignoring traffic work zones, not obeying flaggers' orders. We have flaggers having to take evasive action. Numerous times, we've had flaggers have to jump in the ditch to get out of the way of errant vehicles. One of the things that maintenance and operations folks do is what we call mobile operations. It might be while filling a pothole. So the vehicle pulls up alongside the road, flashing lights, the maintenance crews get out very quickly. You're only going to be on the site for a short period of time, fill the pothole, move on. This is when these are the times without the work zone set up that our folks are most vulnerable. Even when you're laying out cones ahead of the work zone, since the work zone has not been established, again, that is one of the times that our folks are most vulnerable, and that is exactly the case that happened in 2012 when we lost Rob along the Seward Highway. Again, that was a terrible event for us in the department, and we believe that should absolutely never happen again. Nationwide, maintenance and operations folks have, it's a known fact, one of the most dangerous jobs of any profession out there. In many states, more highway workers and maintenance and operation folks are injured and killed than actually police and firefighters. Nationally, more than 35,000 people are injured in work zones every year, and about 700 people, including 130 maintenance and operations and construction workers, are killed in work zones every year. Again, that's 130 workers that are killed in work zones every year. And unfortunately,
Mr. Coffey, you're a little over your 3 minutes. If you could go ahead and conclude your remarks.
Okay. In conclusion, I'd just say that we believe that any steps that we can take to increase the safety for our highway maintenance professionals is well deserved, and any action that we can take to help ensure that our maintenance professionals get to go home each day to their family is supported. And in closing, the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities supports HB 204.
Thank you very much. Representative Christ Tompkins has a question.
Thank you. More comment, Mr. Chair, that I've had the opportunity to work with Mike and deeply appreciate his commitment to the department and the work he does in our communities.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much for your testimony. The only other person we have online is Captain Dan Loudon from the Alaska State Troopers, who is listed as here for questions but not for testimony. We can get to questions for Mr. Loudon in a minute. Is there anyone else that wants to testify that we haven't heard from? Hearing no one or seeing no one else, I'll close the public hearing. And that brings the bill back before us. Did anyone have questions for Captain Loudon? Representative Eastman, I think, does. Captain Loudon, can you hear us?
I can.
Representative Eastman has a question. Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm curious to know if it's your understanding that this legislation would affect that rare situation when maybe a DOT employee was out of their vehicle just to render aid to a disabled motorist or car accident or name the emergency, that type of situation. Is that your understanding?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I'm not a lawyer, and if I took a legalistic reading of the word...
Captain Loudon, could you go ahead and just state your name and your affiliation for the record?
This is Captain Dan Loudon with State Troopers.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, if I took a little reading, maybe not because they're not doing road work. If there were other emergency vehicles there, I think that they would be covered in the sense that there'd be other vehicles there that the violator would be passing. But if they were there by themselves, some folks may read this as they're not covered.
Thank you.
Representative Kropp, it looks like you have a question. Or a comment?
I have a comment.
Representative Kopp has a comment. Not a question. Go ahead, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The mission of the DOT is to keep Alaska moving. Every single thing they do is to keep motorists moving. And road service work is a very broad term. They assist pedestrians and motorists every single day in work zones through directing traffic, telling us where to go, when to stop, when to move, fencing off where we shouldn't go with cones. So in my plain view reading of the bill, road service work is the broadest possible term, which would cover all possible work on the road to keep Alaska moving, and certainly attending motorists who are in need is part of that. And I would, if we disagree, we should just get law probably to comment on that.
And I would just note, consistent with that, I certainly think that if you have a disabled vehicle by the side of the road, that's a hazard to traffic, and assisting with getting that vehicle off the road would, I think, under any and even the most narrow view of road service work, helping to get that vehicle off the road would certainly be road service work. So I think those circumstances, I agree with Representative Cobb. Any further comments or questions? All right. Any final comments from members? Representative Hensley might have a motion.
Yes, you may, Chair. I move version 30-LS0685-D of House Bill 204 with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, House Bill 204 moves from committee. And as we proceed, just be sure to sign the bill paperwork as it circulates through the committee. Next on our list, second order of business, House Bill 79, Omnibus Workers' Compensation, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the governor. This is the third hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Today we are here to continue taking up the various amendments that have been provided. Since our last meeting, we have been working with the Department of Labor as well as industry individuals and labor representatives to address a number of concerns. And after that, Amendments 8 and 9 were drafted and added to the list of the amendments we will consider today. Last week, the committee adopted Amendments 1, 2, 3, and Amendment number 4 was withdrawn. And so that brings us to the group of amendments. And the first thing I'm going to do is move Amendment number 5 to the end of the amendments pending our discussions of Amendment number 8. And with that, I'm going to transfer the gavel to my vice chair for Amendments 6 and 7.
Thank you, Chair Klayman. May I have a motion for Amendment number 6?
I move Amendment number 6.
Are there any objections to Amendment number 6?
Object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. Chair Klayman, can you explain what Amendment number 6 does?
So Amendment number 6 is an amendment that responds to some of the concerns that we received in writing from two or three attorneys that are involved in workers' compensation matters. They were concerned about whether the knowingly fails to report a material fact could actually put providers and others in a position of trying to make a decision of what is or is not a material fact. And this particular language that was initially part of the bill was actually a response to a Alaska Supreme Court case called Shehata, Shehata versus Salvation Army, which appears in the court records at 225 Pacific 3rd, 1106. It's a 2010 case. It basically involves a case in which a worker that was receiving workers' comp due to an injury was having conversations with an insurance adjuster and misrepresenting the fact that he had tried to go back to work and was, in fact, at the time working at the same time that the adjuster was concerned and was actually had hired an investigator to follow the worker around. And there was part of the opinion reflects the fact that the worker was on the phone talking with the adjuster while the investigator was some distance away with a movie camera filming the worker talking with the adjuster, and the adjuster asked the worker, "Are you working?" And the worker said no, and said they might be looking for a job but wasn't working at the time. And in the Supreme Court decision, they indicated that there was a little bit of ambiguity in the statute that made it possible for that made it ambiguous about whether a worker had a duty to report whether they were trying to work, whether it was paid work or unpaid work. And so when you look at pages 18 and 19 of the CS, the subject that's under consideration, what the amendment does is it makes it clear by the language that's removed, but other language that remains, particularly the language in section 33 on page 19, it makes it clear that an employee has a duty to report what work they may be doing while they're receiving workers' comp, and so that when they have a conversation with an adjuster and the adjuster says, "Are you working?" they've got a duty to report that, and if they don't report that, then that subjects them to other provisions in the Act to deal with that issue. And so Amendment 6 satisfies the need to create the duty to accurately disclose the work status of the worker, but doesn't create undesired duties on medical providers and others that was a prime part of the objection from the folks that wrote in. So that's the purpose of Amendment number 6. And I believe after consultation with the representatives of the department that they have no objection to this amendment.
Is there any discussion on the amendment? Okay, hearing no discussion, is the objection maintained?
Withdraw my objection.
Representative Ledoux has withdrawn her objection. And with that, we will... Amendment number 6 is adopted. And we'll go back. And may I have a motion for amendment number 7?
I'd move amendment number 7.
Are there any objections?
And now, for explanation of amendment number 7, this was an amendment that was requested by the department to introduce. So rather than explain it, I would ask Marie Marks from the department to come up and explain amendment number 7.
Ms. Marks, if you could come forward and put yourself on the record.
Good evening. For the record, my name is Marie Marks. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. This amendment was really brought to the administration's attention by the Department of Law, and so I actually have someone from the Department of Law on the phone, Kimber Rogers, who could explain the basis for their recommendations.
Ms. Rogers, are you on the line and can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Can you please state your name and affiliation for the record and then explain to us what Amendment Number 7 does?
Sure. For the record, my name is Kimber Rogers. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in Anchorage. And through the Chair, Representative Sansa, I will kind of describe what the amendment changes. The first four ones that deal with page 4, page 9, and page 11 are all not substantive changes. They're technical amendments to correct some language issues. The real substance here concerns the second injury fund. These are the two amendments that are on page 14. And the idea is that they clarify some procedures and extend deadlines for phasing out the second injury fund. The new Section 27 ends the requirement that employers provide notice of any possible second injury fund claim after claims can no longer be submitted to the fund. The next amendment to the new subsection G explains what is required to submit a claim for reimbursement to the second injury fund. It does not permit claims to be based on a subsequent injury or death that occurs after August 31st, 2017. And it also requires that employers file their claims for reimbursement before October 1st, 2019. And this change, the new addition of the section required some renumbering of sections, which are what a lot of the following amendments deal with. The next substantive one is on page 22. Following line 5, this adds a new subsection to the applicability section, and this new subsection clarifies that the second injury fund amendments apply to notices of any possible claim and claims for reimbursement that are submitted after the effective date of those new sections. That would be the section 27 and 28. And the effective date for sections 27 and 28 is an immediate effective date. This is provided in the amendment to page 22, line 18. And an immediate effective date is necessary so that these sections will take effect before the injury or death deadline that I previously discussed, the August 31st, 2017. And finally, the last amendment dealing with page 22, line 19, provides for a new effective date, September 1st, 2017, for renumbered section 31. Section 31 amends 2330-247C to remove a provision that allowed employers to ask about a person's prior health or disability history in order to document that employer's knowledge of a pre-existing condition for a possible second injury fund reimbursement if the person is later injured at work. And this provision will no longer be needed as of September 1st, 2017 because a subsequent injury or death that occurs at that time will not qualify for second injury fund reimbursement, and so those questionnaires will no longer be necessary. And I'm happy to answer any questions if any of that was unclear.
Are there any questions for Ms. Rogers? Seeing none, are there any discussion or questions regarding amendment number 7 for the amendment mover? Seeing none, is the objection maintained?
Oh, sorry, no, it's gone. I'm next. I'm thinking about the next amendment.
So there is no objection, and that means that amendment number 7 is adopted, and I will now pass the gavel back to Chair Clayman.
Thank you. Representative Fansley, may I have a motion for amendment number 8?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 8.
Object.
Representative Reinbold, can you please explain amendment number 8?
First, I was promised that my name was going to be on here. It's not on here, so if everyone could write their name on here.
And I apologize for
it's that. That's a big deal to me.
And
I've got it in bold.
As do I.
Okay, so with the objection, I'll go ahead and explain what amendment number 8 does. So basically, it revises 28A11H and adds provisions that an independent contractor meet at least 2 of the 3 listed criteria to satisfy the definition of an independent contractor. This amendment loosens the language to ensure that independent contractors are not held to strict eligibility standards that may be difficult to overcome depending on the business size, operation, and services offered. This amendment provides flexibility in determining what constitutes an independent contractor. In the time of financial uncertainty in the state of Alaska, it's important that we foster small business opportunities, including those offered by independent contractors. Independent contracting opportunities keep Alaskan businesses in the business of providing services and professional service to Alaskan and non-Alaskan businesses. Amendment number 8 is a win-win for everybody. So I really want to urge the committee's support. And with that, I want to thank the committee members. I want to thank Mr. Chairman. I want to thank the NFIB and those others that were opposing parts of a previous amendment that may soon be withdrawn, and staff as well for working very closely with us to making this a win-win for all of us. And with that, I would strongly urge support for this amendment.
Any questions for the maker of the amendment? And I note there's letters of support from 3 different groups, and I believe representative from the AFL-CIO can indicate that they too support the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, just follow up. Had a few discussions about this language over the last few days with some folks, and I know there's broad consensus, and I fully support it. Yeah.
Thank you. Is the objection maintained?
No. The objection is withdrawn.
And with that, amendment number 8 is adopted. That brings us next to amendment number 9. May I have a motion for amendment number 9? Representative Ledoux.
Oh, okay. I move amendment number 9.
Object for purposes of this discussion.
Representative Ledoux, if you could explain amendment number 9.
Okay, well, originally I introduced amendment number 2, saying that if somebody hadn't paid the workers' comp within 14 days, that no grace period is going to be allowed and the additional amount would become a penalty under this section. And then the representative from the NFIB pointed out to me that there are businesses, including for that matter the state of Alaska, that pay their employees twice a month rather than every 14 days, and that it would be difficult to do 14 days within the computer systems of people who are on a bi-monthly pay period. So we changed it so that it would be every 14 days or twice a month.
All right. Is there Representative Reinbold?
I'm not sure if anyone in here wants to testify in regards to this, but I actually liked the grace period. But we've agreed 3 times in 24 hours, which is pretty amazing. But this one I just really feel like I need some feedback from those that it's impacting. I don't know if there's anybody online, but I thought the 7-day grace period was actually really nice.
Representative Reingold, the 7-day grace period was eliminated in Amendment Number 2 already. So really all we're trying to do in Amendment Number 9 is go from 14 days to twice a month. We're not really talking about the 7-day grace period.
Okay. I thought I saw in the amendment that it went, through the chair, from 14 to 21 days.
No, it's actually the amendment, Representative Reingold, the amendment changes the 21 and makes it 14.
That, yep. Okay. Let's see here. The 21st day. 14. Okay, so yeah, so it deletes the 21 and it makes 14 days or twice a month. So I don't know if anyone wants to testify. I'm not going to fight this because I already know you have the votes, but bottom line is I don't know if, I mean, I personally would have preferred the past, but if no one is raising their hand out there, Mr. Chair, I know you guys have the votes on that, but I'm unless you want to speak to if there's anything else through the chair.
Unless Representative Eastman, did you want to comment on this? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I like the idea of the amendment. I would just point out, I think under the current construction, if I as an employer wanted to do probably what was unintended by this, I think the language would permit me to, since it's or, I could pay the money on, you know, twice on day 30, and I would be in compliance.
Okay. Representative Reingold, did you have a question?
Well, can I just say, is that an accurate statement?
Okay.
I said, is that an accurate statement for the sponsor of the amendment, Representative Ledoux?
I suppose it could be read like that. You pay twice a month. I mean, that certainly isn't the purpose of the amendment. But you might have a point there.
Well, and I would just note now that we've kind of tried to wiggle down a very, very, very tiny rabbit hole, that what the suggestion, Representative Eastman, is an employer who recognizes that employer has a duty to pay compensation, which is the bimonthly payments, that rather than wait at least halfway through the month to see if the worker is still eligible, chooses to pay in a lump sum for the next 30 days right away rather than pay it twice. I would imagine in that instance, because they're not paying for past time, the idea is you're paying for the time going forward, that if the employee got a full month at a time, the employee probably would have no objections, but I would say the odds that an employer would actually choose to do that is probably an even smaller rabbit hole. So pretty unlikely. But I'm seeing folks from the Department of Labor in the back nodding their heads. Marie Marks, if you could come up and just speak briefly to whether this issue about twice a month is a phantom issue, or whether there's something that makes it any meaningful issue in the real world.
Yes or no.
Oh, no, she can testify. Ms. Marks, go ahead.
For the record, Marie Marks, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. Chair Klayman, just to speak frankly, I think the language is very broad and it opens it up to multiple interpretations and probably would have some difficulties for the division itself to calculate penalties. Having a set date, the division knows can easily calculate when penalties may be due. If every employer is the same. Every employer has the same due date. Having multiple due dates for multiple employers would just make it very, very difficult to apply it as written. And twice a month, I think fairly could be read to be 2 days in a month period, a 30-day or 31-day period.
Representative Ledoux.
Knowing what we where we want to go with this and knowing what the problem is, Does the department have any suggestions as to language which might work?
I don't know how else it would be other than just lay it out there, so that's what I'm going to do. So originally it was set with a 14-day, you pay within 14 days, but you had a 7-day grace period. And so an employer really had 21 days to pay. And I think that to call it 21 days, it was not the intent to shorten it from 21 to 14 days. And so there's a sort of a feeling there that that this period has been shortened and, you know, a feeling to go back to the way it was before rather than, you know, I feel like the administration changed it, and rather I think the feeling is maybe go back to the way it was before, but changing it here. So here, I think the intent is to pay 14 days. And this right here, adding twice a month, I'm not sure that would meet that intent to pay that 14 days.
Well, but it isn't an attempt to make it 14 days. It's an attempt to recognize that there's plenty of employers that pay on the 1st and the 15th or the 15th and the 31st. And so the question I'm raising is, what's the realistic likelihood that an employer that knows they pay twice a month that would go and race in and say, well, I'm going to satisfy responsibility by paying the full payment on the 30th and the 31st. I mean, that seems, while technically a possibility, in the real world, it seems like no employer is going to go and pay the entire payments for 1 month on 2 days. They're going to do once on the 1st and once on the 15th.
In my experience as a hearing officer, anecdotally, that 9 out of 10 employers would follow the intent. I think there is 1 out of 10 that will read it in a way that can be construed differently than against the intent. And it happens, I think it happens enough, and that it would be a concern. There would frankly be nothing outside the bounds of the law to say we paid it, you know, the first 2 days of the month or the last 2 days of the month. But 9 times out of 10, I think most employers are in good faith. But if it was a perfect world, we wouldn't need a fraud unit. You know, we wouldn't be here in a perfect world. We're not, unfortunately, living in that perfect world.
And Commissioner Dragas has joined us. I'm assuming that's because you have something to add to the discussion.
Thank you for the record, Heidi Dragas, Commissioner for the Department of Labor. No, I thought it was worth clarifying that there are different systems when you pay workers' compensation benefits. Typically, it's not the employer that is paying the benefits, it's the insurer. So to have an insurer pay every 14 days or every 21 days is very reasonable. It's part of what they do. There are some self-insured employers in the state, but it's an entirely separate system. The workers' compensation benefits versus regular wages and benefits paid to employees that are working and employed. So I think the attempt to try to fit it into that may not be, to fit it into an employer's version of how employees get paid may not be necessary. That's all I wanted to clarify.
Representative Ledoux?
No, so at this point I'm just tempted to drop the amendment.
But yay.
Before I do, I would like to get Mr. DeWitt's perspective on that.
Representative Eastman, I see you in the queue, but we're going to hear from Mr. DeWitt first.
I'm Denny DeWitt. I'm the State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. As I have explained more than once, I'm not an expert in workers' comp. What I did was I looked at this, and 14 and 14 to me equaled 28, and most months have 31 days. So when you have to make your additional installments every 14 days, you end up, seems to me, with the math problem. And I don't, as I have explained, I don't have a solution to that. I was just concerned that when this goes out, without the grace period, that could create a significant problem for folks who were paying on the 1st and 15th companies. And I've tried to ask a couple of insurers, and I haven't gotten an answer back yet.
Representative Ledoux.
But as Ms. Dragas pointed out, isn't virtually everybody covered through either having a workers' compensation insurance or those who might be self-insured, wouldn't it be like the state of Alaska and you'd have a workers' compensation carrier doing the payments and so forth? So if this is something that workers' compensation insurance people, I mean, it wouldn't seem to me to make any difference whether they were doing it on the 14th or they were doing it on the 15th, and I don't know if we've got anybody here from the workers' compensation carriers to testify, but it wouldn't seem like it would actually impact your clients. It might impact the workers' compensation insurance carrier who isn't here.
Through the chair, everything that an insurance company has to do is charged in premiums, and that directly infects my clients. And that's our concern, is that, I'm not the expert, but it just seemed to us that if you pay on the 14th, you have to pay again on the 28th. If you're trying to do it monthly, that means you've got 3 days into the next month, which puts everybody on a 2-week or a 54-year payment cycle rather than on a 52-year payment cycle.
You may be getting your math wrong.
Yeah.
I'm not going to quarrel with the math.
Yeah, and it's just I raised it as an issue. If it can be taken care of as we go along, I appreciate what the representative was after, and we're not arguing that. It was just a question of, does the math work, and is that why we need a grace period?
And I think the question that Representative Ledoux, the issue that Commissioner raises is that, and I would assume with a lot of small business owners, probably few, if any, are self-insured, and so the point is that it gets referred to the comp carrier. The comp carrier is very accustomed to the 14-day rules, and they actually might prefer to have the 14-day rules and not get confused by the twice-a-month rule. Before we take questions, do you want to proceed with the amendment, or what's your thoughts, Representative Ledoux?
I'd like to weigh in.
Hold on.
I've tried five times, so.
At this point, I'm not particularly interested in the amendment that perhaps Representative Eastman would like to adopt the amendment.
Go ahead, Representative Eastman. We'll hear your comments. Go ahead.
Thank you. And through the chair, I was curious to know if 14 poses a math problem, what would be a way of solving that math problem? Would 16 or 17 solve that problem? What would be your thoughts?
Through the chair, I'm very hesitant to respond because I want to underline that I really don't know enough of the technical issues. But if I were forced, I would think 16 would work because 16 and 16 is 32. That gets you through a month.
Representative Reinbold, you're next in the queue.
We'll debate that later. Anyway, bottom line is, I don't like the language in this. I think a grace period is important, and it very clearly says if the first installment of a compensation due under the subsection is not paid within 14 days or a subsequent installment due under the subsection is not paid every 14 days, I do like it when it says or twice a month, a grace period will not be allowed, and an additional amount will become due. So, yeah, I just find concern with that. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So two comments. One in reference to Mr. DeWitt and the 16 days. I mean, I see the 16 days. I was thinking, well, maybe we'll do it with every 15 days, but then there's some months that have, 28 days and 31 days. And 16 days, I'm not sure, is any mathematically better. And then with response to Representative Reinbold's comments, I mean, you don't get a grace period when you're paying somebody a salary. You can't just say, okay, well, I was going to pay you, every 2 weeks, but I've decided to take an extra 7 days. So I don't see why you should with workers' compensation. I think if I had my druthers on this, I know that the amendment is now before the body, but I'd withdraw the amendment, and I'd say, you know, as this thing progresses, that perhaps we might hear from an insurance carrier to tell us whether or not doing this would become a data nightmare and how to solve the data nightmare, but I wouldn't want to hold up the bill in order to try to figure that out at the moment, because I think we all have an intention to try to make this, you know, work for everybody.
All right. Does that mean you're withdrawing amendment number 9?
If the body would allow me to withdraw amendment number 9, I'll withdraw it.
Completely within your right to do so. All right, amendment number 9 is withdrawn. That brings us back to amendment number 5. Representative Reingold, in light of our action on amendment number 8, do you wish to withdraw amendment number 5? I guess not offer amendment number 5.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a comment and just say thank you for working with AFL-CIO and NFIB and through your office. I think we came to a really great compromise. It's hard to do sometimes, but I think it worked really well. And with that, I will withdraw amendment number 5 with the appreciation also of passage of amendment number 8.
Thank you, Representative Reingold. That brings the bill, House Bill 79, back before the committee. Any further discussion or comments from members? Representative Ledoux.
We didn't hear the department weigh in on amendment number, yes, it's amendment number 8. Is the department good with amendment number 8?
Representative Dragas just put her thumb up to indicate that the department is good with amendment number 8.
Well, I'm really both impressed and amazed that this was accomplished. So, you know, I thank everybody who was working on this to actually come up with what appears to be a win-win for everybody.
Mr. I have one comment on that.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux, for pointing that out. And I think it's a great example of the public and private sector working together towards a common goal of taking care of employees. We often think that one cares and the other doesn't, and that's wrong. And this is a good example of that. Thank you.
All right. Any other comments about anything about House Bill 79? Going, gone. May I have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move version 30-GH1789/O of House Bill 79 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, House Bill 79 moves from committee. And again, if you will sign the paperwork as we go forward. Our final order of business today is Senate Bill 55. Omnibus Crime Correction, sponsored by the Senate Judiciary Committee. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill is Chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Coghill. Where is Senator Coghill? He was here a minute ago.
He just poked his head in.
We're going to take a brief at ease until Senator Coghill and his staff come back to see us. We're back on record. Here to present the bill and introduce as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator John Coghill, and his staff, Jordan Schilling. If you could both come forward, identify yourselves to the record, and you may begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I appreciate you taking the time to hear Senate Bill 55. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 55 was born out of recommendations that came from the Criminal Justice Commission. It's mostly technical in nature, and I say mostly because some of it is conforming. So it's technical, conforming, not quite revisor quality statute, but it's pretty close to it. And what we tried to do was we put many of the recommendations in Senate Bill 55 and left big policy calls in Senate Bill 54, which has taken on a different life of its own, as you well can imagine. So what this does is it works on things, and I'll have Jordan Schilling go through the sectional on it, but it's really based in things that the Department of Law brought to the Commission, they brought to us, things where we put something in one statute, and through the amendment process, it didn't get a conforming change, so we're just conforming those changes. That's primarily what the bill does, and we've tried to keep it as clean as we can technically so that during this kind of interesting session that we live in, that this would help both the Department of Law, Department of Transportation, DMV, all actually work while we hammer out some of the policy call questions, which are probably a little bit bigger. But this is all work that came through a rather large omnibus crime package, as you all know, that has had its own huge debates and many amendments through the process that since it was such a large bill, there were places where we just needed to line the statutes up. That's pretty much what this is, Mr. Chairman. And to his credit, the person sitting next to me, Jordan Schilling, has really been a good detail worker in this particular area. And if you wish, Mr. Chairman, we can go through the sectional on it so that you can just get the high level of what issues we're trying to line up.
Mr. Schilling, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. I've got kind of a sectional with some commentary, and I can just sort of walk through each section one by one if you'd like. Sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill all do the same thing. In 2015, the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission recommended that the felony theft threshold be raised. That's the dividing line between misdemeanor theft and felony theft. And the commission said not only raise that threshold, but link it to inflation so that the legislature does not have to act in the future on that issue. However, and again, as Senator Coghill said, you know, with a 193-section bill, it's inevitable that there will be some drafting errors, and this is one of those cases. The drafters inadvertently, in three instances, linked the higher amount, the grand larceny $25,000 amount, to inflation adjustment. I think this was just inadvertently a result of a floor amendment that happened on the House floor last year. Section 4 of the bill relates to drug possession. As recommended by the Commission in 2015, simple drug possession shall be a misdemeanor. Of course, there were exceptions to that recommendation. There are still...
Hold on just a second. Representative Ledoux has a question.
Yeah, I guess I don't see why the adjusting for inflation, why that would be considered a technical amendment. That actually looks like a fairly substantive change to me.
Through the chair, Senator Ledoux, the reason it's considered technical...
It's actually Representative Ledoux. She's
Representative Ledoux.
Motion, but she's not there yet.
The reason the commission considers it a technical change and the reason Senator Coghill considers it a technical change is that, you know, the commission never recommended that that amount be linked to inflation. Had we caught this last session, we would have obviously removed it from the bill. We worked with Representative Klayman's office on this inflation adjustment amendment for the House floor, and Mr. Chairman, you may want to speak to the intent of that amendment, but it was our understanding that the intent was never to link $25,000 to the inflation adjustment.
Representative Ledoux, go ahead.
If you're adjusting things for inflation, why didn't you mean to do that? If, in fact, you're saying now, or Jordan's saying, that you didn't mean to do it.
Representative Ledoux, to the best of my memory, because this is a detail that I know that was the subject of a floor amendment, I believe this was one of the situations where we had a compromise in which we agreed at the lower level we would adjust for inflation, but at the higher level we would not.
And I can help with that, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cobb, his memory is apparently better than mine.
It is the lower level that determines the first level of felony when you're going from misdemeanor to felony. And that was the variable that had changed so much since 1972 when we had first set it at, I think, $500, and then the math showed it was now $8,000, $9,000. But the broad agreement was that $25,000 would probably always be a B felony throughout our lifetime and the next lifetime. But it's that lower level that is more sensitive to the market and inflation and actual value of when something is the items that are most frequently stolen and is market sensitive, because it is a lower amount going from the misdemeanor to a felony theft, where the higher amounts are really not is sensitive to the threshold that they're attached to in the felony scale. There always are felonies, will be felonies, but the lower level is when you go from misdemeanor to felony. And that's where all the debate was around, is when something should go from misdemeanor to a felony. So that's where the discussion was.
So,
Representative Ledoux.
So I'm hearing that this was the result of a floor amendment, but I don't remember any of those floor amendments actually passing. So I don't know how it would have gotten there as the result of a floor amendment.
And Representative Ledoux, I agree with you. I actually think it was not a subject of a floor amendment. I think it was a function of the amendments that we did in the Judiciary Committee last year.
And so I guess that leads to my question is your recollection that we meant to do this in the Judiciary Committee, in which case it's not a technical amendment?
Well, I think I would suggest it is a technical, because we did it, but we did it in most sections, and so they were what Mr. Schilling is explaining is that there were a few sections that it looked like it was drafted erroneously. So this is conforming the bill, conforming the statute to what was the intent of the amendment, not the amendment, but what was the intent of the bill as it came through. I see Ms. Mead in the background as well, can add to the discussion. Ms. Mead, do you want to come and add to the discussion?
Maybe Ms. Mead can remember what we intended to do.
Through the chair, for the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I do want to clarify that as you can see, the wording that's being eliminated there, adjusted for inflation, is provided in 1146.982. The problem is you don't have to worry about your intent so much, because AS 1146.982 says specifically that the Judicial Council will only adjust for inflation, the $250 amount and the $1,000 amount. They don't have authority anywhere to address the $25,000 amount. So that really was a case of the drafters going through, and every time they saw something adding adjusted for inflation, but erroneously doing it for the dollar amount that isn't authorized to happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Does that answer your questions, Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
All right. You can proceed, Mr. Schilling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And after the hearing, I'll try to provide some information on where that change entered Senate Bill 91. Section 4 of the bill relates to drug possession. As recommended by the Commission, Senate Bill 91 made simple drug possession a misdemeanor. There are exceptions, of course. There are felony forms of possession in the law. But those changes inadvertently created some overlapping penalties, specifically for possession of less than an ounce of a 6A controlled substance. So what this section does is it eliminates those overlapping penalties. Further, what the section does is it accommodates for the fact that there are felony forms of drug possession referenced in other statutes. They simply need to be referenced in Section 4 as well.
Representative Ledoux.
What do you mean by overlapping penalties?
So through the chair, Representative Ledoux, page 3, lines 3 and 3 through 6 This is the statute that makes simple possession of drugs an A misdemeanor. And as you can see, it makes possession of 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A, 5A, and 6A an A misdemeanor. However, there is another statute that has another penalty for possession of less than an ounce of a 6A substance. So there's a statute that makes it a B misdemeanor for someone to possess less than an ounce of a 6A controlled substance, and there's another statute that simultaneously makes it an A misdemeanor.
So I think what I'm hearing is you're saying that they're inconsistent penalties. Okay.
That's correct. And through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we've chosen to default to the B misdemeanor, which is how it was prior to Senate Bill 91.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. So many times I've heard you talk about we're doing the same thing in Texas as we're doing in Alaska virtually. So can you describe how similar or different the drug issues are in Senate Bill 91 in Alaska versus Texas?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I'm actually not an expert on the sentencing framework that other states have, and generally when we speak about Texas, we speak about it as being one of the first conservative states that embarked on these types of criminal justice reform efforts. That is not to say, though, of course, that we simply mirrored the policies that other states have, like Texas. So I'm unfamiliar with what they do with drugs down in Texas.
Representative Reinbold.
Mr. Chairman, I would definitely like to talk to this committee in regards to the difference that they do in Texas. Many, many times people have misled. I've been in many, many committees where they're making it look like we're doing the same thing. We're doing dramatically different things than they're doing in Texas. And I would like the opportunity to discuss that at a later time. But this is of huge concern to my district and public safety officials, and I definitely have some pretty significant concern with Section 4, but we'll let him get through this, but I just want to get that on record.
Representative Eastman.
That's okay. My question was answered.
You may continue, Mr. Schilling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 5 of the bill relates to victim notification. Senate Bill 91 created a new requirement of the court. It required that information regarding sentencing be given to the victim, as well as an opportunity to allow the victim to update their contact information with the VINE system. VINE as an acronym stands for Victim Information and Notification Every Day. However, the language was not written in a way that would accommodate for the fact that many victims simply don't show up to court. And because of this, the court system has been out of strict compliance with the statute. And, you know, oftentimes we hear that victims in some cases don't want to be a part of these hearings. And so because it's not the court's role to maintain a list of victims and to maintain a list of their contact information, it would be inappropriate to require them to seek out these victims and provide this information. And so instead the language, if practicable, was added in recognition that many victims don't ever show up to court.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker and Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask permission to read Section 24 of the Constitution.
Representative Reinbold, I appreciate that interest, but I don't think we need to hear that as he goes through the bill section. I'll be happy to hear the comment later, but I don't think we need to take that up.
Right, Mr. Chairman, it absolutely was 100% applicable to Section 5. And that's why I passionately disagree with this, if practical. I think that if we swear to uphold and defend the Constitution, it's only fair that we're allowed to read a section of the Constitution.
When we get to comments on the bill, I'll give you the opportunity
to read
the Constitution.
This isn't comments on the bill. This is comments on Section 5.
I appreciate your perspective, but we're going to move on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one point of clarification, this requirement to provide this form to victims is a brand new requirement that never existed prior to Senate Bill 91. It's a piece of information that we felt strongly the victim should have, and we established this in law last year. And if we had identified a need for the words if practical, we would have just simply done it last year. But to move on to Section 6, Sections 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 all have to do with the suspended entry of judgment. Last year, the Commission recommended a diversionary tool called a suspended entry of judgment. It resembles, in a lot of ways, an SIS, a suspended imposition of sentence. And this SEJ, again, was established under Senate Bill 91. It was intended to operate a little bit differently than the SIS, in that a defendant who was granted an SEJ would not have a conviction entered in that case and would therefore be able to avoid some of the consequences resulting from a conviction. So what Section 6 says is this is a statute that provides for an array of authorities that the court system has. This is the statute, this is the general statute that gives the court system the ability to impose community work service, fines, sentences of imprisonment. And so we simply need to add a reference to the suspended entry of judgment in this statute just to make it explicitly clear that the court does have the authority to impose an SEJ. Section 7 also has to do with an SEJ. This section is necessary to bring SISs and SEJs a little bit closer into alignment. It ensures that when a restitution order is made as a requirement under an SEJ, that the responsibility to pay this restitution does not go away or disappear when that individual successfully completes an SEJ and their case is discharged. The requirement to pay restitution remains just like under an SIS.
Representative Reinbold.
Can he please describe the differences between the two?
Between a suspended imposition mm-hmm. of sentence and a suspended entry of judgment?
Correct.
Go ahead.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the big difference is that a judgment is never entered. The individual is truly not convicted. And that individual's record does not end up on court view, and they can legally say on an employment application that they have not been convicted of a crime. This is designed generally for low-risk first-time offenders. If you have any additional questions on that, I'd probably defer to the court system or Department of Law.
You can continue.
Section 8 of the bill also deals with an SEJ. One thing that wasn't clear in the SEJ statutes was whether a brief prison stay could be imposed similar to what can occur under an SIS. And so there were some questions from practitioners. Is there an option of imposing a brief period of imprisonment for individuals going through an SEJ? And while the commission never intended shock incarceration, for example, to be used under an SEJ, and if they had, they certainly would have recommended language that allowed for it, the commission felt it was prudent to clarify in statute that incarceration may not be imposed as a condition of probation under a suspended entry of judgment.
Representative Reinbold.
Could you give more rationale? I just find this tying the hands of the court. The court may not impose a sentence of imprisonment under this section. So I really would like to know more information about, and I'm not a fan of the Criminal Justice Commission. It's no secret at all. But I absolutely really would like to understand why you're tying the hands of the court with a little more detail.
Sure. Representative Reinbold, through the chair, simply because the commission never recommended shock incarceration be able to be imposed under an SEJ. That's about as simple of an answer as I can provide. It just wasn't the intention of the recommendation.
And I see Senator Coghill has joined us. I think he has more to add on the topic.
Chairman, thank you. And I just thought maybe it would be good to be reminded that under the suspended entry of judgment, the judgment is still there. The idea is to get them in a treatment, and they complete the treatment in order to have that judgment suspended and then set aside. So there is a treatment capacity in it. So it's an accountability measure, and in order for them to have the judgment laid aside, they have to actually complete the programmatic requirements. So.
And isn't it one of the issues on a suspended entry of judgment that the court has actually made a decision to suspend entry of judgment and send the person to treatment program? So actually at the beginning of the process, the court has actually decided, without being told it can or it can't, the court's already being told, has already decided that it will give the person that opportunity. So the court isn't having its hands tied. It's basically, this is just recognizing a court that has decided to give an individual that chance to rehabilitate and not get a conviction, that in fact there won't be a conviction.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's right. What you might call it is a methodology that would be a tool that that a court could use or may not use.
Right. Representative Reinbold?
Well, I'll agree to read this as clear as day. The court may not impose a sentence of imprisonment under this section. And I guess what my concern is here is I understand the rationale better now, but a lot of times there's not programs available in certain areas, and there's certainly not funding for them. And so I'm trying to see, you know, what the end goal. If funding is not available and treatment is not available, then the court may not even help them with programs inside the prison, then what?
Senator Coggill, I think.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Reinbold, the issue is if they are available, the court may use them. If they're not available, chances are the court would not suspend an entry of judgment because they just couldn't practically follow the rule. So,
follow up, Representative Reinbold?
I didn't ask for one. Thank you.
Representative Eastman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I'm not familiar with this particular chapter enough to know. How broadly or narrowly is imprisonment defined? Certainly, if we're talking about, you know, long-term jail, I get that. What is it? Anything broader than that? So, if the court, you know, said, hey, you know, you need to be confined to the hospital for some period of time, is that, does that fall under imprisonment or halfway house? Or can you speak to that?
Representative Eastman, we're on Section 9, not on Section 8. There's no discussion of imprisonment in Section 9. Do you have a question about Section 9?
Yeah, it was going back to Section 8.
Do you want to answer that question in connection with Section 8? We'll go back to it. I just was confused.
Yeah,
Mr. Chairman. And Jordan Schilling, Staff Senator Conklin. I thought we were on Section 8 as well. My apologies. But I don't know if there's a definition for imprisonment in Title 12. It's just been my understanding that when the word imprisonment is used, that we're referring to incarceration at a DOC facility. And I have seen statutes that refer to home confinement and electronic monitoring, and they use different terms if it's something other than a hard bed facility within the DOC.
Okay, thank you.
So I may have been mistaken. I thought we were in Section 9. Either way, we got the question answered. Apologize if I was confused. All right, you can continue.
Mr. Chairman, Section 9 also has to do with the suspended entry of judgment. Existing law says that if a person successfully completes probation under an SEJ, that the court may discharge the person, dismiss the proceedings, and they may dismiss the proceedings any time after 1 year from the date of the original probation. But there were practitioners that were confused by this language and whether the language was referring to the start date or the end date or, you know, at what point in the probation are we talking about. And because probation terms are longer than a single day, it's an increment of time. It makes sense to add the words was imposed. It's really a grammatical thing to clarify that the statute is referring to the start date of the term of probation. And also this section again, clarifies that a person is not convicted if they successfully complete an SEJ.
Representative Reinbold.
Can you go back and describe before, were they ever convicted when this is the SEJ? Were they ever? Because right now this language says a person who is discharged in the section may not be convicted of a crime. I want to look at the full ramifications from the beginning to the end in regards to that.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, it's a good question. In an SEJ, the individual is never convicted, and so this just makes it crystal clear that, again, that individual is not convicted.
Yet he or she has to do probation and a whole bunch of other things, so I guess there's something missing here. If they're not convicted, then why are they on probation?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, that is one of, in fact, the unique thing about SEJ is that the individual faces a lot of the consequences that you would see associated with being charged with a crime and is required to do things, perhaps community work, perhaps fines, perhaps treatment. However, the big difference and the thing that sets SEJ apart from other things is that the individual is not truly convicted, and, of course, they avoid the consequences that follow a conviction such as being on court view and not being able to say on an employment application that they have not been convicted.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess I have, this is just kind of a bizarre to me. And so I just, they actually have convicted and they've actually committed the crime, but this is kind of a way to erase it, it seems like to me. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this just seems like people have the right to know if someone did commit something, and they are able to see it on court view. And this is kind of like, oh, you were, but we're kind of just keeping the secret between ourselves. I mean, if I'm inaccurate in any of this, let me know. I'd like to know. But that's just what this appears.
Through the chair, was that a question?
Yes.
Through the chair, Representative Rundle, can you repeat that question?
Explain to me who was going to know about this in the suspended entry judgment. Did they actually commit something, but they're not convicted? I mean, there's something missing here.
Through the chair, Representative Rundle, that's exactly how it works. They're not convicted, and as a result of that, the record does not appear on their court view criminal record.
But they committed it.
Representative Rundle, you got it exactly right. It's a procedure the court has been under the criminal justice reform. It's a tool that the court has for somebody who has committed a crime, who admits to having committed a crime, to give them an opportunity to rehabilitate themselves. I fully understand that you actually don't agree with that part of the criminal justice reform efforts, and your distaste for that is clear.
Mr. Chairman, I was just trying to understand. This is an issue that's been of great alarm, and I wanted to make sure that it gets on record.
It's clearly on record. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Reinbold, just to be clear, a suspended entry of judgment means that a justice process has occurred. Someone has, in fact, been found guilty, and a suspended entry of judgment means there is no written record into the official record of conviction. Only if the defense and the prosecution agree that can be set aside if a whole list of conditions are fulfilled on probation and the legislature made off limits a whole number of crimes, all the person crimes, sexual assault crimes, you cannot get a suspended entry of judgment on. Yeah, sure, Mr. Schilling will correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a whole number of offenses, almost any serious offense you can think of doesn't really qualify. These are lower level offenses and this is the whole purpose behind this was to allow first-time offenders a chance to avoid that initial conviction, which ends up in the death spiral of unemployability for the rest of your life. But their safeguards are it pretty much doesn't apply to any violent crime against a person, and you have to have the prosecution agree and the defense agree that this is a better way forward for this particular individual. And so that was the discussion behind this. If someone violates that probation and many standards that are put in place, you know, they're going to lose their ability for that suspended entry of judgment to happen to them, and it'll end up being a conviction. So it's actually a pretty refined process.
Representative Reinbold.
So I guess I'd like to put on comments. Once again, it seems to be a secret. You know, a secret between the courts, a secret between I just think that the people have the right to know, and I think that the Constitution is very clear with it, but I've got my concerns on record, so I'm happy to move on. But
thank you, Representative Reinbold. Mr. Schilling.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Section 10 is really a continuation of the conversation we just had. Section 10, as you can see, and again, this is the suspended entry of judgment, uses the words convicted of and convicted in three instances. And again, because the individual has not been convicted, it makes sense to refer to the charge rather than the conviction. And then the fourth replacement of the words convicted of with is charged with is for a different reason. As Representative Kopp mentioned, there's a number of exceptions. There's a number of individuals that are not eligible for an SEJ. An individual who has been charged with, the statute now says a person convicted of a crime of domestic violence is not eligible. Well, convicted being past tense leads some practitioners to believe that that might be referring to a previous conviction of domestic violence. What we want to ensure, though, is someone who is currently right now being charged with domestic violence would not be eligible for an SEJ. Section 11, Mr. Chairman, this section eliminates overlapping probation term lengths. Senate Bill 91 established maximum probation term lengths, and for example, one of the maximums was 15 years for a felony sex offense. Another maximum was 10 years for an unclassified felony under Title 11. And the problem with the language that's in the bill now is that there are felony sex offenses that are also unclassified felonies under Title 11. And so, there's an ambiguity, of course, about which maximum probation term length would apply, and this section clears up that ambiguity. Section 12 and 13, Mr. Chairman, do the same thing. One of the things that Senate Bill 91 did is it raised the maximum fine amount that can be imposed for a Class A misdemeanor from $10,000 to $25,000. This was, I believe, a part of the aforementioned House Amendment, but I will do some research on that, Mr. Chairman.
That one I'm certain came out of House Judiciary Committee. That did not come out from the floor. That was in the House Judiciary Committee.
I'm going to get some research, Mr. Chairman, for you.
I can. I'd specifically remember this, and I can tell you about it.
So this is these two statutes require certain information to be on the protective order forms. These talk about what the penalties might be for violating a protective order. And the form says that one of the possible penalties could be a fine up to $10,000. Of course, that's no longer the maximum fine. And so these two sections simply update the information on the form to specify that the maximum fine can actually be up to $25,000.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. And where does this money go? Does this go to the courts? Does it go to the general fund? Is it restitution? I mean, where does this fine go?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I don't know the answer to that. Nancy Mead may. However, really, this is just a technical change that conforms our fine statute with the protective order statutes in Title 18.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Reinbold.
Technical as it may be, Ms. Mead is in the room, and I definitely appreciate an answer. Thank you.
She's coming up.
Thank you. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, all fines for all crimes go straight to the general fund.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, Section 14, continuing on, has to do with license revocations, and this section removes a reference to the type of dismissal that would serve to meet the requirements of this section. Removing this reference to prejudice is appropriate because the intent of this policy is to return the license to the individual if they've been acquitted or dismissed, regardless of whether the dismissal was with or without prejudice. And so this simply removes the reference to prejudice and gets back to what the intent of that policy was. Section 15 of the bill, Mr. Chairman, this is a new addition into Senate Bill 55 from the Senate Finance Committee. In 2015, the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission recommended that municipalities be prohibited from having greater punishments under municipal ordinances that go beyond the punishments for similar offenses prescribed under state law. And SB 91, of course, enshrined that recommendation in statute, but afterwards it came to our attention that folks were interpreting the language to not only apply to crimes and placing that limitation on municipalities with respect to crimes, but also non-criminal offenses and traffic infractions. And this has had the effect of limiting a significant revenue stream for example, the municipality of Anchorage, and creating an inability to collect greater fines for even things like traffic infractions. And so what this does, because it was never the intent of the commission to limit municipalities' ability to do that with non-criminal offenses, this simply changes the statute to apply only to criminal offenses.
Representative Reinbold.
Mr. Chairman, is this similar to House Bill 223?
Identical language.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Section 16, the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission recommended that agencies be required to collect specific data on key performance measures and to analyze the data, make reports to the legislature, and to continue to make recommendations and to play kind of an oversight role for the next 5 years. And due to an apparent oversight, the bill missed an important data point that really does need to be reported to the commission relating to earned compliance credits. I can go into more detail, Mr. Chairman, but it's just an important data point that we think that the commission needs to have. Section 17 has to do with the ASAP program. That's the Alcohol Safety Action Program. And what this section does is it aligns two bills that were in the legislature at the same time and passed around the same time. Last year's Senate Bill 165, Representative Kopp may be familiar, but what this did is it made minor consuming alcohol a violation, and it provided that the fine for this violation may be reduced if that juvenile, you know, successfully participates in the ASAP program. And what Senate Bill 91 did is it limited the types of offenses that can be referred to the ASAP program. So to accommodate for the fact that Senate Bill 65 felt strongly about sending these juvenile offenders to ASAP, this section of the bill adds those two juvenile offenses to the list of offenses that not only the court can refer to ASAP, but the ASAP program can accept. Mr. Chairman, Section 18 eliminates a notification requirement for a parole hearing that just will never occur. This is a statute that says that individuals who have committed a crime against a person or arson in the first degree, that if they become eligible for administrative parole, notification should be sent to the victim. However, those individuals are just not eligible for administrative parole. Therefore, no notification will ever need to be sent, and it's really just an unnecessary statute that is being repealed here. Section 19 and 20 are the applicability provisions. One of them clarifies that any decision made by the Board of Parole prior to January of this year is not somehow invalidated by the passage of a certain section of Senate Bill 91. And then just general applicability provisions with respect to the entire bill. And then Section 21 provides for an immediate effective date of all of the sections of Senate Bill 91. And that is the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for the presentation, and I want to thank you as well for meeting with the staff of Judiciary Committee members yesterday to review the bill. I'll note for members that it is my intention to move the bill from committee today. Are there any further questions from the committee? Representative Reinbold.
I have an objection to moving the bill. I think we're rushing this through. This is our first presentation. This is huge. I think public safety is government's number one mandate, and I think there's some pretty significant concerns with some of these issues, and I absolutely object to rushing this through in a 30-minute period. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Reinbold, you'll certainly have an opportunity if we move the bill today to register your objection at that time. Do you have any comments? This is an opportunity if you want to read Section 20 or Amendment 24 to the Constitution. It would certainly be an appropriate time to read that.
And I appreciate this opportunity, but I definitely believe that earlier would have been better. But Section 24, Rights of Crime Victims. This is Article 1, Section 24. The Declaration of Rights. Crime victims, as defined by law, shall have the following rights as provided by law. The right to reasonably protect the accused through the imposition of appropriate bail or conditions of release by the court. The right to confer with prosecution. The right to be treated with dignity, respect, and fairness during all phases of the criminal and justice process. The right to a timely disposition of the case following the arrest of the accused. The right to obtain information about and be allowed to be present at all criminal or juvenile proceedings where the accused has the right to be present. The right to be allowed to be heard upon request at sentencings before or after conviction, juvenile adjudication, and at the proceedings of the accused release from custody is considered. The right of restitution from the accused. The right to be informed, and that was one of my key issues. Upon request of the accused escape, release, custody before or after conviction, or juvenile adjudication. I just think it's very, very important that we keep the Constitution at close hands, and I am very concerned that some of the changes, massive changes with Senate Bill 91, but even with these technical changes, I'm concerned that it does not follow some of the intent that's in the Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm going to go ahead and open the public testimony for Senate Bill 55. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm looking online. We have some people available for questions. Tony Piper from Division of Behavioral Health. John Skidmore, I think he may actually be closer to an airplane than available online, but we do have other representatives from the Criminal Division here. Jeff Edwards from the Parole Board. And we've already heard from Nancy Mead. There's no one else on the list to testify. So hearing no one in the room and no one on the list, we'll close the public hearing. That brings the bill, Senate Bill 55, back before the committee. I will note that we only received one amendment, which was from Representative Reinbold. We received that amendment after noon, which was the deadline for receiving amendments, and the subject of those amendments is addressed in two other bills, Senate Bill 54 and House Bill 228, which is Representative Reinbold's bills. Bill, for both of those reasons, I'm going to rule that those amendments are out of order and will not be considered. Is there any further discussion of Senate Bill 55 from members of the committee? Representative Eastman.
I'm curious about that last statement. Obviously, not all the bills that come before the committee are going to get passed. I think the idea of an amendment is probably to put it on a bill that will pass. So how would the fact that information was in another bill that may or may not pass keep us from putting an amendment on a bill that we're dealing with today?
Well, when we have the exact thing that's already actually been referred to a different committee, that's taking that work away from that committee. So but the amendment was also late, so even if it, for both of those reasons, I'm relying on both those reasons not to hear the amendment today.
What's the push for making it such a short time period to consider this particular bill?
In my view as committee chair, we need to move the bill, so we're doing it.
No particular reason, just because.
Nope. Any final comments from members of the committee? Representative Reinbold.
Mr. Chairman, I'm very disappointed. This is a pretty short notice getting the bill, a very short hearing. We have the right to know what we're voting on before a bill is moved out of committee. I do not fully understand this. I have lots of work that I still need to do in regards to talking to victims. I didn't know public hearing, so I thought it was very unfair that we didn't get to have people call in today because you didn't notify us. In regards to this amendment, it was just very few minutes short because legal was backed up, and I think it's only fair for us to be able to put our fingerprints that I don't think this is a communist type shut up and do as I say and you can't put your fingerprint on the bill. I don't think that's fair, and I think that my amendment being ruled out of order is unnecessary, and I absolutely passionately object to not being heard in regards to my concerns and being able to amend this bill. So I got it on record, and it's very, very disappointing.
Thank you very much. Any other comments from members?
It's a good bill, Mr. Chairman. Let's move it.
Thank you, Representative.
I have a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Eastman.
Going back to Section 15, I did get some constituent feedback on that, and I'm wondering, is there any discussion perhaps on whether or not, as we're tightening down what municipalities can do in several respects, criminal justice, we're sort of potentially encouraging them to have higher costs on citations. Is there any more discussion on, what's driving the desire for those higher costs?
I think Mr. Schilling may be able to answer that better than anyone.
For the record, again, Mr. Chairman, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill, Rep. Senator Eastman. The reason for the change is because the commission never recommended that this limitation be imposed on municipalities in a way that restricted them from doing their own thing when it came to non-criminal offenses. It's just simply not what the commission recommended, and it was our thought that when this language was in Senate Bill 91 that it did do what the commission recommended to turns out through interpretation after the bill was signed that it did not. So we're making that change.
Okay. May I have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move version 30-LS0119-T of Senate Bill 55 with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Is there any objection?
I object.
If we could call the roll.
Representative Ledoux?
Yay.
Yay. Representative Banzler?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Eastman?
No.
Nay. Representative Reinbold?
No.
Nay. Representative Koch?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Price Tompkins?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Clayman?
Yes.
Five yays, two nays.
By a vote of 5-2, Senate Bill 55 moves from committee. We will adjourn for the day, and our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, Friday, April 14th at 1 p.m. On Friday, we will hear House Bill 200, Nonpartisan Open Primary Election, sponsored by Representative Ledoux, and we will hold a public testimony on that bill. We will also take up House Bill 208, Trusts, Community Property Trusts, and Powers of Attorney, sponsored by Representative Johnson. If time allows, we will also hear House Bill 1, Election Registration and Voting, sponsored by Representative Tuck, and House Bill 13, No State Municipal Funds, Federal Immigration Registry, sponsored by Representative Josephson. If anyone is considering offering an amendment to House Bill 200, please let my office know and please submit them by 5 p.m. tomorrow to allow time to distribute them before Saturday's meeting, when it will be my intention to take up amendments to House Bill 200 and move the bill out of committee. And with that, we will stand adjourned. It is now 7:21 p.m.